Hello, welcome to Cape York, Far North Queensland. I'm Lyndall Scoble from Cape York Natural Resource Management. Let me show you around this beautiful region and introduce you to its extraordinary people in our podcast series, My Cape York Life. Cape York is 137,000 square kilometres, but it's home to just 20,000 people. You'll hear stories of the challenges and rewards of life in this remote, beautiful and fragile landscape. Cape York stories, told by the people who live here.
We did correspondence, and if they did Scoot of the Air, I could just stop the motor car and throw an aerial in a tree, sing out to one kid on a horse. He'd gallop back and talk to his teacher for half an hour and go. I'd pack up again and keep following him till the next fellow had to go on.
From here where we are now, we are about an hour and a half drive from Cookdam. Sort of in the middle of the heart and soul of everybody around us.
Laura's a historical town. It was one of the stopovers for the prospectors and miners that went from Cooktown across to Maytown.
Jumping on crocodiles with Australia Zoo. Was it the helicopter monitoring? 2 weeks in the Torres Straits on the reef heron were pretty spectacular. I did all sorts of stuff. I was a very lucky trainee.
We'll always think of something, I suppose, a bit more to do than that, eh? Yeah. That's old Jack reckon, if you don't think you're going to do something, mate, he says, you're finished then. You've got to keep thinking, there's a lot you're going to do to keep you going.
My Cape York Life is brought to you by Cape York Natural Resource Management, with support from the Australian Government National Landcare Program. You can find all our earlier episodes of My Cape York Life from your podcast app, or stream it from landmanager.capeyorknrm.com.au. This time, we're in Cooktown, the beautiful and famously windy town at the southern end of the Cape York region. And we're sitting on the banks of the Endeavour River with Waratah Nichols, artist, teacher, community dynamo. Waratah has seen a lot of the world and of Australia, but she fell in love with Cape York when she came to the region for a festival in the early 1980s. She's been here ever since, travelling all over the Cape as a teacher and artist, working in remote Indigenous communities. Waratah lives in and cares for a beautiful isolated spot south of Cooktown, Mungumbi. I think you'll be inspired by her passion for Cape York.
My name's Waratah and I live at Mungumbi Valley, which is at Helenvale. Most people would know where the Lion's Den pub is. So if you actually stand at the Lion's Den pub and look across the road and take a leap of a couple of kilometres, you'll end up in my backyard. The Mungumbi River or creek runs through the property, and I have a little area that I've cleared, which I've planted fruit trees and built a house there. And that's my little private piece of paradise, but I seem to spend a lot of time travelling around Cape York and going into communities, doing community art projects and environmental arts projects.
How did you end up there?
Well, I came to Far North Queensland in the early 80s. And I came to go to a bungle in the jungle, which was a little festival that used to happen at Oroville in Bloomfield. I really just fell in love with this area, and I fell in love with a man, which kind of, you know, is a definite draw card. So I settled down here to have a family, and I have three children that are all grown up now. My eldest is 34. So my kids are in the area, but they're not obviously not at home anymore, and I have grandkids as well here in Cooktown. So yes, I've made this area my home. It feels like home to me. I was a little bit of a traveller. I actually came from overseas. I came from England, travelled all through India, and landed in Western Australia. So I lived in Western Australia for 3 years, living in the sand dunes in Broome, being a Mung Bean, as they called us, and then down in the southwest of Western Australia. I travelled around and did a lot of different things, like working. I worked for a diamond prospecting mob over in Western Australia. I worked on the prawn trawlers in the Gulf of Carpentaria, and just travelled and looked, you know, checked out the country, but met a wonderful group of people when I was in Broome. And sort of spent a fair bit of time with them. We used to go to the southwest down around Denmark area, mm-hmm. and live down there when it was too hot in Broome, and when it got too cold there, we used to head back up to Broome again.
That was a long time ago. Are you still in touch with some of those people?
Yes, I am, actually. I'm hoping to have a bit of a reunion with some of them in March next year when my son's getting married in Melbourne, so I'm going to do a trip down there and catch up with some of those old mung beans from Broome.
So you end up at Mungumbi.
Yeah.
You have three children. What was it like for your kids growing up, and what was it like to raise children so far away from sort of big towns and, you know, the cities where you grew up and experienced as you were growing up?
Well, I grew up on a farm. My parents were artists, and so I actually sort of probably had quite a similar upbringing in a way than I brought my kids up, though. I grew up in the countryside in England on, you know, 5 acres of land, where my parents tried to be self-sufficient on the land. And we tried to do the same here, but it's a very different environment. It's trying to grow food in the tropics and living in a place where in the wet season when it floods, you don't go out, you stay home. My kids didn't have TV and they didn't have all the technical on IT stuff that kids do these days, but they certainly learnt how to entertain themselves. We formed a canoe club, and we also had an inline hockey club going. When my boys were teenagers, we spent a lot of time canoeing on the creeks around here and doing annual trips down the Mitchell River, going from Cooktown Crossing down to calmer waters.
So that's quite a distance.
I actually don't know what the kilometres are, but I know it used to take us 4 or 5 days, and it was
wow.
just wonderful. We used to jump, we had canoes and kayaks, and so we'd just cruise down the river, and when we found a good parking spot, we'd all pull up on a nice sandy bank and light a fire and cook up some tucker. We used to dry food for sort of months beforehand in readiness for these camps, because you don't want to carry very much in the boat, so broccoli, potatoes, everything used to get dried. We'd dry meals and then we'd rehydrate them. Mm. And it was absolutely wonderful. You'd be cruising down the river, going down the rapids, and you'd see all the wonderful wildlife, freshwater crocs and lots of cormorants and shags, but different birds, little kingfishers.
Mm. Yeah. So just thinking about your kids growing up, what do you think living in a more remote community, not having TVs and not having that instant access to sporting teams and those kinds of things that kids in the cities or in the towns might do, what kind of skills do you think it gives them for preparing for adulthood?
They become very self-reliant. I can remember my son would head off from home in the Mungumbi Valley in the wet season to go and visit his friends in Rossville. And he would swim across flooded rivers. He would be, you know, walk down the road, maybe get a lift or maybe not, maybe, you know. He would walk across country. I could tell you one story that to me at the time was horrifying, but when I look back on it, I can see how incredibly resilient these kids are. When one of my sons was 4, he went to walk down to the local beach, which was probably a 40-minute walk through the rainforest, with a 5-year-old. Supposedly tagging on behind was the dad of the 5-year-old. They ended up taking the wrong turn and walking over to Oyster Bay. And when they were coming back, they missed the saddle and walked around Rattlesnake Point, which, if anybody knows Rattlesnake Point, it's this really steep headland that has a lot of little ravines in it, and it drops straight down into the ocean where there's rocks and wild waters. So these two little boys walked around this headland and came back onto the beach at sunset. So it's a 40-minute walk back through the forest home, and when my son was walking along the track, he hit a tree and went, I can't walk any further because I'm going to lose the track. And so he said, oh, to his mate, let's just sit down here and go to sleep. You know, I'm, of course, really worried at home about where's my little boy. But when we actually caught up with him, they walked back and came, at dawn the next day. And when I said to him, how was it sleeping in the forest, he said, well, the mosquitoes were pretty bad, Mum. But the worst thing was my friend just kept crying for his mum and waking me up.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, so they just adapt and they just do it.
Yeah.
So which son was that?
That's Adam. He's still up in here in North Queensland. Yeah. So he's 30 now. Yeah.
So you've raised your family here, and you've got quite an interesting working background as well. You yourself are an artist. You've done quite a bit of community work. Can you take us back to sort of the beginning, where some of that started, and tell us how you got into arts and community?
Well, apart from my parents being artists, in the 1980s, I did a project for the Year of Youth where we did a festival in Townsville. So it was an International Year of Youth. And we did a lot of weaving and mask making. I was involved with some other people. We used to create adventure playgrounds out of bush materials, big baskets and nets that we'd put up into trees. And we used to be hired by the festivals to do this. Mm. So I guess that was sort of the beginning for me of community arts projects. Then I joined a bike ride in Adelaide, I think in the Year of Peace, which was 86. And so we rode around to different schools and communities talking to people about peace. And I went from Adelaide up through the Flinders and along the Oodnadatta track and up to Alice Springs and ended up in Darwin that year. And then went into the Northern Territory, into Arnhem Land, where I ended up on a little island called Murunga, which is off Melanggimby, teaching people how to plant gardens there. Yeah, that was just before I came to Far North Queensland, so that was my trip.
So you've always had an interest in gardening as well. Where does that stem from? Is that from growing up on a farm, do you think, or have you things that you've picked up along the way?
Definitely from growing up on a farm. I mean, I was probably digging garden beds when I was 7 or 8 and killing chickens and plucking them and pulling their guts out at that sort of age as well. So, yeah, I think that the values that my parents imparted was that we need to look after ourselves, be sustainable, know where our food comes from. That's really important to grow things organically and live a healthy lifestyle, a lot of that's about being responsible. If you're always getting your food from the supermarket, then you're not responsible for what you're eating. You have got no idea most of the time what has happened to that food, how it's been treated, what it's been exposed to in the way of chemicals, poisons. You don't know whether those chickens or those cattle have been treated well or whether they've been abused. So I think that was a big part of my growing up, was my parents sort of taught me about animal husbandry and about growing our own food and how important it was to know where your food came from.
Mm. So you've been growing your own food at home for a long time now. Is there a particular style of growing that you follow? And what kinds of things are you growing at home?
Well, I was greatly influenced. I actually trained to be Rudolf Steiner teacher, and part of that Steiner teacher training, which I did in the early 90s, was learning about biodynamics. So I think the biodynamic methods have influenced my style of growing, but really I think it's a lot about observation, about seeing what works. It can be quite haphazard as well. It's like you plant things and they do well, and you plant things and they don't do so well, and so you kind of get to know what plants grow where you live. I have a lot of tropical fruit trees like Rolinias, Jabodicabas, Gramichanas. Avocados, they seem to grow fairly well, but I have a bit of difficulty with avocados. They suffer from Phytophthora, which is a fungal disease. In the last few years, I haven't been focusing so much on gardening because I've been doing so much work outside of home in the community. And it's kind of nice to see that I can still walk around my garden and pick things, knowing that I really only just sort of cut the grass a couple of times a year,
yeah.
And it's still producing. So maybe putting all, a lot of that early energy with the biodynamic preparations into the land actually built the soil up so that, that it's supporting the plants. Because basically what is behind all my growing is that you feed the soil. If you feed the soil and you feed the soil microorganisms, you don't kill them with things like urea and chemical fertilizers. You build the soil microbes and they actually feed your trees and your plants for you.
And is that what biodynamic farming is?
Biodynamic definitely is about using the forces of nature, but it's about using the forces of the cosmos as well. There's unseen forces that we are working with. You know, the unseen forces might be the forces of the moon and the sun, but they're also the forces of, at different times, it's like different times the sap is rising, and other times that the sap is just stagnant or still. So you need to work with the cycles, and the cycles are ruled often by the planets and the sun and the moon.
You haven't had as much time to spend on your garden, and that's because you've been doing so much within your community. And, I mean, we've just walked along the waterfront here in Cooktown and seen installations that you've put in here and artworks that you've worked on and festivals that you've been involved in. So when did you start working on community projects in your own community?
Let's think. I think it goes back a long way of just holding little festivals. We used to have these All One Family gatherings that we were called, which were actually alcohol, drug and smoking-free events. So that was really interesting. We didn't get a lot of locals coming, but we used to get people coming from overseas and from down south. So we actually did allow tobacco smoking, but it was like there was a specific space. So we were way ahead of our times, really, with that, because we're talking about back in the 80s. Mm. Yeah, we had people coming and doing workshops. We'd have maybe 100, 200 people would come to those festivals. So they were only small. Mm. But we'd cook. Everybody would sort of join in. People would bring some food. So maybe they would bring a sack of potatoes or a box of apples, and it was all a community. It was a big community gathering, so it was part of the All One Family gatherings, which were around in the 80s. After I had done my Steiner teacher training, I came back to live in far north Queensland. And there was no Steiner schools up here, so I was sort of thinking what I was going to do with that. And I started just teaching art at the local school, which was Rossville School. Then the principal said to me one day, you know, how is it going? And I said, oh, look, it's going really well, but I'm volunteering and it would really be nice to be paid. So he said, well, there is funding available, but you will need to go to all the schools in this cluster, which was including Lakeland, Bloomfield, Laura schools. And so we put in for funding, and we got the funding through the PCAP program, Priority Country Area program. And I developed this program called Acadia, which was art, craft and drama in action. I'd go into schools and deliver this program with different classes, doing anything from silk painting to making candles, making masks, doing little puppet shows. And it was really, really successful. And so where PCAP normally funded programs for 3 years, they actually funded my program for 10 years.
Wow.
So from 96 to 2006, and probably would have kept funding it if I actually hadn't got a job working as the manager of the art centre in Hopewell and didn't have the time to do that program anymore.
Mm.
But I travelled all over the Cape up to Mapoon, then out to Herberton, Irvine Bank, Bibura, Gelatin, Mount Molloy, as well as all the schools around here, Hopewell and Cooktown.
So that must have been an incredibly rewarding kind of role. Obviously the kids get lots of learning out of it, and arts are such a great way of teaching people about everything. But for you personally, doing that kind of work, you've developed up this program, you're working all over this amazing place called Cape York. What did you get out of it personally?
Oh, there was certain things that I mean, it was an amazing experience. It was wonderful to meet all the different people that I met, and I felt that it was really valuable, was the information I was sharing. Often the lunch times became little sort of seminars on Steiner education to the state-trained teachers who were really interested in my teaching techniques. But another thing that I noticed was the change in the children. Often I'd go to a school like, say, Laura School or some of these other little schools, and I'd be there for a week. So over a period of a week, I would actually see a change happen in the children. At the beginning of the week, they might be more stressed, and by the end of the week, they would be playing a lot more, that they would have relaxed and they would be engaging a lot more. A lot of people said that children would often only come to the school in the week that Miss Waratah was there, because they really enjoyed that. The learning was experiential, which means it's learning by doing, and I think this style of teaching actually suits children, particularly Indigenous children, much more than getting them to sit down and try and absorb facts. I think that by engaging them in doing something, they can learn so much. Mm. You know, you can create patterns, teach children about maths, putting on plays, having to learn words, you know, all these things are really good skills for children.
Waratah Nichols, artist, teacher, traveller, community dynamo, having a chat with us on the bank of the Endeavour River in Cooktown, Cape York Peninsula. My Cape York Life, stories of people who live in and care for Cape York Peninsula. We're with Waratah Nichols, who lives at Mungumbi, south of Cooktown, since she fell in love with the place on a visit in the early 1980s. She's worked on many projects across the Cape, including a stint managing the Indigenous Arts Centre at Hopevale, north of Cooktown.
Well, I was there for 2.5 years, and we had a lot of programs running. There's the actual Arts Centre, the new building itself, happened while I was there. There was some funding in place when I took over as manager there, but I basically sort of was part of the process of getting the design and getting all the funding people on board to get that new centre built. We had programs that were of the elders going into the schools teaching art and culture to the children. The Yimbala dances actually started then. Well, it didn't really start. I mean, the dances had been going for a long time, but we revamped and brought in some other people to help get the dances choreographed so that they were looking a bit more professional when they were performed at Laura Festival. One of my favourite programs was Weave the Web, which was a leadership and capacity building for Indigenous women. Mm. And it was funny how that came about, because some of the women had been telling me that they wanted to go to other communities to learn other weaving techniques, and they wanted to be able to teach the weaving techniques that they had, which was using the local bajin, which is the lamandra grass, the blue grass, but this is the dry country grass. So I was approached by some of the funding people who said that they'd like, you know, that they had money for this leadership and capacity for Indigenous women. And so I turned around to the women and I said, look, we can't find funding for the weaving program, but we've got funding for leadership and capacity building. So if you women are happy to actually learn about how to run a project, how to deliver a project, and you're happy to be part of the planning, and we'll do some leadership workshops, then I think we'll be able to get this funding for you to go around to the different communities and share your skills and learn new ones. And so that's what happened. We went to Garma Festival in Arnhem Land, and we went up to TI to the cultural festival, the Winds of Zenith Cultural Festival, did a 3-day weaving workshop there with the women from out on the islands. And they shared the Hopevale women shared their skills and learnt new skills. So it worked really well.
That's fabulous. And I know from conversations we've had how much you enjoy working with Aboriginal women, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women across, well, across the country, but certainly on Cape York. And you're doing a little bit of that again now.
Well, right now I work for the Woodjawoodjal Community Justice Group as a youth coordinator, so coordinating the youth programs in the community. And but I have been working with the women in Woodjawoodjal for a couple of years prior to that in the Women's Centre, doing a lot of art and craft, particularly printing, and doing a lot of camps out on country or days out on country, hunting and or fishing.
Spending so much time with those women in community and on country, you must have seen some things and learnt quite a bit yourself and had an amazing amount of personal growth.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I feel quite honoured to be in this the situation that I am, of because I feel that I'm in a situation, a position of trust within the community, and I have a lot of love for the people that I work with, and I know that they have a lot of love for me, and that is really special. It's really special to be able to be accepted like that.
You've recently gained a bit of an interest in environmental arts, so I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that, how that came about, and what you've been working on in that area.
Well, Andrea Gower, who's my colleague, and I were actually approached by Cape York Natural Resource Management to create programs that would teach people about our environment through the arts, particularly talking about the environmental issues on Cape York Peninsula, looking at different ways that we could actually change people's behaviour by creating an awareness of those environmental issues through using art. So through our partnership with Cape York NRM and UMI Arts, we developed the Cape Create Crew, and from that came Litter Ed through Transforming Trash, which was funded through the Department of Environment and Heritage, Queensland Government, and it was through their litter and illegal dumping program. So we were focusing on, particularly on litter and illegal dumping. We travelled around to events. Initially we went to Weipa Fishing Classic and to the Laura Festival. That must have been 3 years ago. And then we've travelled as far as Thursday Island now and been to Bamaga, to the MPA schools, to Old Mapoon and Laura Lakeland schools down at Woodjawoodjal. And so what we do is we go into the schools, we get the kids to bring in a whole big pile of rubbish, and we'll give them a presentation talking to them about what happens to mainly plastics when they get out into the environment. And, you know, a lot of it is quite shocking. The kids don't understand that these little tiny pieces, these, well, the plastic bottles break down into smaller and smaller pieces. And when they end up in our waterways and in our oceans, the birds think that it's food. The fish thinks that these little pieces of plastic are food. Birds can feed the plastic to their young, and the young can die because they have a belly full of plastic, which blocks their intestinal tract, so they die of starvation. We show them some pictures, we tell them what is happening with the rubbish, make them aware that if they throw their rubbish on the ground and it ends up in the waterways, that it can have very damaging, painful effect on other living creatures. And then we get the pile of rubbish that they've collected and we turn it into art. And, you know, one of the most wonderful things is at the end of the day, you watch these students go home and they have made a toy out of something that would have just ended up in the trash bin. And they're so proud that they've made something, that they're playing with it. It might be a plane made out of an old wooden hanger and a plastic bottle, or a car which has got lids for wheels. We do use spray paint, because with it, you know, this is sort of one thing that it just makes those toys look, jazzes them right up. If you spray the plastic bottle silver or gold or black or whatever colour they might want. But we use glue and hot glue, and they have so much fun. And, you know, it just always amazes me that at the end of our presentation, and we've told the students how they can reduce plastic in their life, and we've shown them a few different ideas of things that they can make, and they've got that pile of rubbish, and you see them, they're like little hawks. They look, they know exactly what it is that they want. And they can go through and they'll grab out a bottle and a box and just turn it into something else. And their creativity knows no bounds.
And those environmental messages that the kids are learning while they're doing the arts workshop, what are they learning? And how is that impacting their future choices around rubbish disposal?
Well, we've interviewed some of the children after the workshop, and I know some of the things that they've said is, oh, if I'm sitting in the car with somebody and they throw rubbish out of the window, I'm going to tell them to stop and go and pick it up. What else has there been?
You were mentioning at you're up in Bamaga a few weeks ago, and you did a presentation at a documentary screening, and you were talking about as you were showing some of the statistics, the audience.
Well, yes, we just mentioned that in the presentation, it was actually at Seisha Fishing Club, and there was about 90 people had come to this evening. And when I said there's 18,000 pieces of plastic in every square kilometre of ocean, I heard very audible gasps from the audience. Mm. And
that's incredible, isn't it? It's a lot of plastic.
18,000 pieces of plastic. And that's everywhere we're talking about. This is sort of like you must have seen photographs or footage of rivers that are just jam-packed solid with plastics or bays. But the plastic is everywhere. It's in the Antarctic. It's in areas that we think should be totally pristine. But the plastic is everywhere. Mm. You can go to surfing beaches where nobody lives, or islands where, you know, nobody goes to, and there's plastic washed up on the beach.
And that's interesting for, like, a place like Cape York, where you see so much plastic washed up on beaches, and quite often people can assume it's a local problem. Is it?
Well, sometimes it's a local problem, but most of the plastic that's washed up on the beaches up here is actually from elsewhere. I was recently up at the tip of Australia, and Andrea and I were there, and we did a bit of a beach clean-up at the 5 beaches there, and we were picking up... Most of the bottles that we picked up there were actually Indonesian. And you could see the writing on them. I don't really like to admit this, but I worked on a prawn trawler in the early 80s, and it was the general practice on the prawn trawler was that when the garbage bag was full, you tied it in a knot and threw it overboard. Mm. And that was just how you dealt with rubbish. You know, in Australia, people have become a lot more aware, but I think overseas, particularly in Asian countries, where... In the past, all the bags were made out of banana leaves or coconut leaves, and you villagers make a coconut leaf basket at the beginning of the day and take it to the fields and fill it up. You know, when they do, after they finish their work, they put the taro or bananas or whatever in the coconut leaf basket and bring it home. And it wouldn't matter if they dropped that on the ground and sweep it into the local creek. But then when that bag becomes plastic, they are treating it in the same way that they've always treated their bags. And so the education is so important here. Mm. But when I was a child, there was no plastic bags. We would go, when you went to the shop, you took your shopping bag and your potatoes were put into paper bags. Yeah. We need to go back to that sort of thinking.
And what role does the arts have in that kind of education?
Imagination is really, really important to everybody. Everybody, you know, we all have an imagination, and it's a great learning tool. When we experience something, then we can change our behaviour through that experience. And it works so much, particularly from children. I mean, you must have heard mothers say, use this. You can talk to that child till you're blue in the face and they never listen. But if you sit down and do something with them, they will always remember that. And so this is what experiential learning is. It's about giving a child a problem or giving a person a problem and then helping them work their way through that problem. That way you never forget it.
That actually leads me into the latest project that you've been working on, Moritar, something called...
The Gateway to the Cape.
How did that come about? Just tell us a little bit about it and how you're weaving experiential learning into that project.
The Thoughtful Travelling Group came up with this wonderful idea of Lakeland being the gateway to the Cape. We needed ways of getting the message out to travellers who were travelling up the Cape about the environmental issues that were there and about the impacts that they may have on our environment, and whether this was the way that, they were toileting or whether this was the way that they were dealing with their rubbish. So the Gateway to the Cape is about bringing awareness to people who are travelling up into the Cape and to teach them about the issues, the environmental issues, and about how they can actually help alleviate those issues.
So what is it?
Well, it's a traveller's information stop, but it's far more than that. We're looking at we wanted to do something that was really a little bit different. So there will be a building there that will shelter people, but we're actually going to build a sculpture park that has sculptures that are representative of the creatures or features of Cape York Peninsula, which have messages about things like, if I can give you an example, if you drive on the sand dunes on the Western Cape, you may be squashing turtles' eggs. If you throw your litter out at a campsite, then that litter could get washed down into the creek. You go out fishing and you throw your smelly plastic bait bag overboard, then that's going to be an environmental hazard for the fish and for the birds. And it's all part of destroying our environment. We all love our environment. I don't know about you, but I notice going through the airport or looking at any travel magazines, there's mostly photographs are about beautiful environments, and we want to keep it that way. So the Gateway to the Cape is about helping keep Cape York a beautiful and special place that it is.
Lovely. And why Lakeland?
Well, Lakeland is a turn-off off the Mulligan Highway to the Cape Peninsula Development Road. So it's the place that and most travellers will be going through at some stage on their way up to Cape York. And so it's a perfect spot there.
So when can we expect to see this gateway, do you think?
I think certainly in 2018 we're going to see some of part of it. It's going to be a big project. What we want to do is actually create a park that is full of sculptures, but it's going to be a game. So you, as the playing piece, will be able to interact with the game as you walk around the park. There may be pavers with messaging like, you picked up someone else's litter at your campsite, so go forward 4 paces. Or we may have a crocodile sculpture made out of tyres next to a paver that says, you swam in crocodile-infested water. So game's over, really.
That sounds lovely, sounds fascinating. Just to wrap us up today, you've lived on the Cape for a long time now, and you've seen lots of changes. You've seen lots of amazing things happen, and I'm sure that you've seen some not so amazing things as well. But what is your wish for the Cape for the future?
I would like to see that people that are living on the Cape are becoming, I mean, I know there's a lot of people who live on the Cape really love the Cape and they love the land and they are committed to preserving the beauty and specialness, the uniqueness about this country. I think my fear is about big mining companies, development coming in and destroying what we know we need to preserve. And so what I would love to see is that when people come to the Cape, that they come to enjoy it, that they really respect it, that they understand the specialness and the uniqueness of the environment, and ultimately that they have great respect for that our country. And by having great respect for that our country, they don't do anything that's going to harm it.
Thank you. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Thank you for letting me share my story with you.
Waratah, it's been absolutely beautiful sitting here. The sun's about to set, and the sunset on the Endeavour River in Cooktown is the most magnificent one, I think, in the country. Everybody loves it, absolutely. But as the sun is setting, the sandflies are starting to come out, and it might be time to call it a day.
Thank you, Linda.
Waratah Nichols, artist, teacher, long-time Cape York resident, speaking to us next to the Endeavour River at Cooktown, Cape York Peninsula. Next time, we're at the Bloomfield River to meet Mari Shipton.
I come from Widjawidja community. My country is sea country, Jajigal country, and also Kugunyungul country in Shipton Flat. The place where we're sitting down there at the mouth of the Bloomfield River is my grandfather's traditional owners for this country, my mum's dad, and enjoying this view, watching the crop going past on the other side of the river.
We've got some beautiful thick forest up there, hey?
Yes, that's where they say where the rainforest meets the sea.
Whoa, it's a damn big island.
I'm Lyndall Scoble from Cape York Natural Resource Management, the makers of the My Cape York Life podcast. My Cape York Life is supported by the Australian Government's National Landcare Program. You can find previous episodes on your favourite podcast app or Google Cape York Land Manager. And you can find Cape York NRM on Facebook and Twitter.
I tell you my little home is Cape York.
I'll see you next time on My Cape York Life.